I would define a Christian in the concept of the historical usage of the term in the New Testament and in church history, which I think will stand up under any scrutiny. A Christian is a person who not only follows the ethics and the moral structure of the teachings of Jesus Christ, but is also a believer in the person of Jesus Christ as the Savior of the world, as God in human form, that he literally died on the cross as an atonement for our sins, and that he rose bodily from the grave as our mediator in heaven. Now, this is following... let me finish. You asked me for a definition. This is perfectly consistent with the Old Testament concept of Isaiah 53 and of the Jewish concept of the offering for sin, which is the Passover offering.
Yes.
All I'm saying is, and I don't mean to imply by using the word cult that this is derogatory. I think perhaps
you've
taken offense at this.
No, it is.
It's a dictionary term, and I use it in that sense.
It's a dictionary term, but it's used in a derogatory way.
Well, if I've used it in that connection where you're concerned, I apologize. But
do you think
I'm looking at it merely as a classical usage of the term, that's all.
Reverend Martin, as a teacher of theology, do you feel there's a possibility that the stuff in Isaiah that predicts Christ or predicts a Savior could possibly have been added a little later, or could have meant a spiritual understanding, a spiritual thing that could come to each person separately?
Well, I would answer this by saying that, first of all, the problem of dating of Isaiah is no longer in question. The Dead Sea Scrolls have given us a copy of the Isaiah manuscript as far back as 150 B.C., which means that the antedating manuscripts...
Did that have stuff in about...
Oh, yes, it did, indeed. So we know that at least 150 years before the birth of Jesus of Nazareth, the prophecy in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6, which many Hebrew scholars in Judaism are content to ignore, and it's a very difficult passage, I agree. It reads in Hebrew very strongly, and this is what it says. I'm quoting from Isaiah chapter 9, now verse 6. His name shall be called. This is generally considered by pre-Christian commentators, that is, Jewish commentators, as a messianic passage. His name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, El Gabor, that is, the Mighty God. Now, Isaiah gives to a human being the title of Jehovah, the Mighty God, Father of the Everlasting, Prince of Peace. Of his kingdom there shall be no end, and upon the throne of his father, David, that's literal as literal can get, he shall rule the nations with a rod of iron. The zeal of Jehovah of hosts will perform this. First of all, the dating cannot be called into question. And secondly, there is no possibility of a spiritualization because ancient Judaism recognized messianic prophecy. So there is no possibility of a way out of that. I'm not trying to make a case for Christianity having all the answers to everything. I am trying to make a very strong case for the fact that there is an intellectually defensible Christian theology which doesn't really get a fair hearing in many quarters.
Well, in our cults, we feel that we have gone back to the first centuries after Christ and are trying to follow his teaching much more than some of the other things that you've added on to include. But I don't know why anyone that follows the teaching, that tries to follow the teaching of Jesus, wouldn't be called a Christian.
Well,
I don't know why we
way,
have to believe that he died for our sins. Why can't we believe that he was rather stubborn, and he knew if he went to Jerusalem he'd get into trouble, and he went anyway?
Well, may I put it this way, if I might give a direct answer to this. I'll put it this way. The only record which we have of the life of Jesus Christ is found in the Synoptic Gospels and the writings of the Apostles. This is your prima facie source material. You have some Roman sources. You have Flavius Josephus before the close of the first century. You have some quotations and the Talmud, of course, afterwards. So the historicity of the existence of Jesus Christ is never questioned, at least by anybody seriously who has read the records. What we're dealing with, and this is an important point, is that simply because a person follows the ethics and the moral structure of the teachings of Christ does not ipso facto make them a Christian, any more than my following the Noble Eightfold Path of Buddhism makes me a Buddhist. In Christianity, it is first and foremost the person of Jesus Christ which commands the attention of the New Testament writers. Now, if you read from Matthew through Revelation, one thing emerges clearly, if you're honest. You read it in Hebrew, or read it in English, or read it in Greek, it still comes through to you. These men experienced something. They met a Nazarene carpenter who was very stubborn. As a matter of fact, he was the most dogmatic man that ever lived. He said, I am the Son of God, and if you don't believe that I am the Son of God, then you will be judged into all eternity for my rejection. Now, this was bound to get him into trouble because this is a very dogmatic position. Now, the whole New Testament record presupposes, beyond a question of a doubt, that Jesus Christ claimed to be God in human form. There is no room for saying, simply by following the ethics and morals of Jesus, one becomes a Christian. This will not hold water historically, because you can have a system of ethics which resembles Christianity. You can have a system of morals which resembles Christianity, but you cannot have Christianity. And I know people who are very, very sincere in practicing, let us say, the Sermon on the Mount, attempting to keep the ethics and morals of Christ in the New Testament. But this is not enough, because the Master said that I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. Now, I agree, this is dogmatic. But must admit that it's Christ's teaching. We just can't ignore it.
All right, so then we get Reverend Martin to the interpretation, and if you've read these different pamphlets, if you wrote these different pamphlets, I am the way, the truth, and the life, didn't you say?
Yes, I did. I'm quoting Christ, John 14:6.
Yes. Now, we feel that when he said, I am, he meant something different from what you think he meant.
Well, what we must do is look in the context and find out what it means in the language. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life.
Yes, we feel that the Christ within each person is the way, the truth, and the life.
But we're assuming what is to be proved. We have not proved that there is a Christ within every person. We have merely made a definition. We have arbitrarily split Jesus of Nazareth into two individual schizophrenic personalities. One is Jesus, a man, and the other is a Christ idea which indwelt him. But it's the testimony of the apostles. Matter of fact, let me go to Roman Catholic theology as my supreme proof here. I think I could historically. I mean, this is fair to go historically to Catholic theology, and I would draw upon it. Matthew 16:18, the great passage which says, I say unto thee, thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Now, Christ answered Peter. Now, this is significant. Christ said to him, Blessed art thou, Simon, son of Jonah. For flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father which is in heaven. Then Peter said, Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now in Greek you have three definite articles, each one emphasizing the Christ, the Son, the living God. Jesus is not a man indwelt by the Christ idea. Jesus is the Christ. You don't have any Christ idea within you, and I don't have any Christ idea within me. Either Jesus Christ dwells in you by faith, or you are a Gnostic of the first century, simply trying to use Christian terminology in an attempt to profess Christianity, and I don't think it'll work historically.
Let me just interrupt here for a moment to take care of some business. We're talking this morning with the Reverend Walter R. Martin. He is assistant professor of biblical studies at King's College, Briarcliff, New York. P.J. Sidney actor, Miss Gray, bookseller, and Roy Schatt, photographer. Anybody want to buy a bookstore for a low price? It'll be available in another two or three weeks. P.J.
Well, I'm going to digress just for a moment. Apparently, there was some merit in Miss Gray's objection to your using the word cult. It turns out that one of the definitions, and this is a definition which, although perhaps by denotation may not be the single one, but by connotation, I think she was right in her objection. There's one listed as great devotion to some person, idea, or thing, especially such devotion viewed as an intellectual fad. And I think that that is the character which the use of the word at this period in history has.
PJ is reading from the dictionary.
I should have made this one statement in conjunction with this, that writers such as Braden and Bach, whose theological position is liberal, whereas mine would be conservative in Christian theology, use exactly the same term, giving a definition in the preface as to exactly what they mean by this. I do the same in my books, and I didn't define it, I suppose, because I assumed a priori that I was speaking in the context of non-Christian cult systems. I defined a non-Christian cult system as a group of people gathered around a specific person's interpretation of the Bible, claiming historic Christianity, but specifically denying doctrines of Christianity. This is a specialized definition for a specialized field of study. We've got to remember something, that in the United States, the field of cults has only come into consideration seriously by the Christian Church in the last 15 years. And that up until that time of the entire history...
50 or 15?
15.
15
That's correct. As a matter of fact, when I started writing in the field and doing research on the subject, study of my writings at this point would show that I have written more in the 10 years in the research area than had been written in the previous 75 years on the subject, because it had lain dormant. That is, everybody was terribly afraid to say anything for fear everybody was going to be offended. Now, I think we live in what might be called, if I quote the late President Kennedy on this in the Saturday Evening Post, he said, dare to think, to speak, to write. For when controversy dies, America dies. And this is the American controversial spirit.
I'm awfully sorry that a lot of people were unaware of that statement, because they certainly don't practice it in America.
No, they certainly
no,
do
they,
not.
They don't.
And when you enunciate controversy, as we're doing on controversial points, at least we're getting a hearing of what we think on the subject. People are listening to us and they're saying, well, this isn't put up. PJ really doesn't agree with Walter. Roy doesn't agree with PJ. Eden doesn't agree with maybe the three of us. And John is sitting on the
maybe
deciding which way he's going to go next, you see. But at least we're having a discourse. And I see nothing wrong with controversy if it's for the sake of exploration and knowledge. But if it's just for the sake of rearranging our prejudices, then we're wasting our time. We might as well not have controversy.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that that is what we're engaged in here.
I hope not.
As a matter of fact, John, I must make a confession here. I talk behind your back, and I suppose I might as well tell it now.
You can stand in the corner later, but yeah, let's hear what I
have. Actually, I think that this program is probably the oasis in America.
Amen.
Where people can really say what they think without any regard for repercussions or anything else happening as a result. A great deal of obeisance is paid to free speech, but free speech usually means free speech if you believe what I believe. And I have had...
Just a moment, PJ. Repercussions? Have you not read the telegrams or the hate mail that...
That's not...
Yeah, but this is not a repercussion. You see, a repercussion...
Pressure, I think, is what you mean.
Yes, pressure and effective pressure, yeah. Which is to qualify it even further. I mean, you know, the pressure is one thing, but if the pressure has no effect, it doesn't mean anything. And I say to you, you know, that this is quite remarkable. I keep being surprised on this program, actually, because I've had the very good fortune, as you notice, Reverend Martin, I'm a bit of a talker, and I used to bore people in living rooms. And fortunately, I found a place, you know, where talking was desirable. So, you know, this is really a very happy combination. But actually, I've had the good luck to be on the show many times, and the number of topics that have been discussed and have been discussed with a great deal of openness and freedom makes this, in my mind, and I do a lot of thinking about it, there's a lot of reading about it, a lot of talking about it, a real oasis of free speech in America.
Well, I agree with that, because you see, we live in what might be termed today, if I may exercise this right of free speech, in what might be called an Emily Post era, in which you can't say anything from the real sense of controversy, even an honest disagreement, without every pressure group and lobby on God's green earth trying to beat you over the head for either exploiting, discriminating, neglecting, rejecting, or trying to do something to see there's some minority group or group that is trying to do a job. For instance, if you speak against the funeral business, such as Jessica Mitford did, instantaneously you have an orbital shot from the Undertakers Association. This is all wrong and so forth. There's no point-by-point refutation.
I just did it last night.
It's all wrong.
Oh, John, you were wonderful last night.
And so far...
Thank you, Eden.
You are back in his good grace.
Well, bookshop.
She knows.
Inspiration House.
Buttering him up, buttering him up.
Does she know how to use that?
She certainly does.
Listen, she brought a pound of butter with her.
But this whole point is this Emily Post idea is you can't offend, you can't say anything. And if you criticize a thing, then immediately it's personal. Somebody says, well, you don't like me because you don't like my philosophy or my theology. Now, I don't agree with the theology of Gnosticism, and I don't know which cult you were speaking of before is one that you're a member, Eden, but my concern for the perversion of Christianity under the name of Christianity does not mean that the people who hold a specific position necessarily have to be hated, or that you've got to have an open war with them, you can't get along with them, you can't have a relationship of rapport with them. I think this is absurd, and that's what we're getting today. It's getting to the place where it's almost un-American to disagree. And I think this is one of the great things that's getting to all of us today, and that's why I can say this, John, with no commercial, I may never get back again. And
already booked in four shows in my mind right now.
If that's the Lord's will, all right, but let me honestly...
Well, I've got some rough ones coming up for us. The guys are really going to cut you to shreds.
Well, they're welcome. There's a lot of me.
I
do think we have a chance to at least say something.
This is only a warm-up period. You don't understand.
Yeah, well, as long as it doesn't get too hot, I mean...
Let me read a couple of telegrams here first. This is from John Martin. This is no relation to Reverend Martin. At least I don't think so.
I don't think so either. I don't know any.
No, it's a very pleasant telegram.
I'm sure of that.
But I don't think the fellow would come out with this. Reverend Martin is astonishingly brilliant. Well, a magnificent mind. Will Roy Schatt please keep his mouth shut for 5 or 10 minutes? Better yet, send him out for sandwiches. He keeps interrupting PJ, who is also marvelous, signed John Martin. Well, John, many times I disagree with Schatt, and you know, this is kind of a thing we talk, and then maybe for 2 days we don't talk anything. I think you're wrong tonight, because I don't think that Roy has really interrupted at any time.
Poor Roy hasn't
said
one
thing. I think that Roy has had little opportunity tonight, and this is not defending Roy. It's just the way I feel about it. Here's another one. Barbara Blakesley. If there is a supreme being, and if this being has given man a so-called free will, should this being be blamed for human fallacies or weaknesses along with being blamed for man-made religions from the beginning of time? Buddha, Jesus, Confucius, etc., were possibly great prophets of their times, but still were Homo sapiens, not the supreme being. What about one universal religion based, I think they mean it's B-A-S-E-S, but it must mean based on the Golden Rule, signed Barbara Blakesley. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, I'll comment. I don't know whether anybody will agree with me, but at least I'll comment. First of all, there are two points she's making. The first is free will.
Mm-hmm.
Now, free will and freedom naturally implies responsibility. Freedom is not license. We're free in the United States, but you're not free to go out and throw a brick through a window, because if you do, your freedom has become license, and they're going to put you in jail for it. Now, when God gave man the capacity of response, when God made him free, when God created another will other than his own, he automatically had to do one of two things. Either it was a robot, and in such cases there is no responsibility, it's only a reflection of the Creator, or there is freedom, and with freedom the risk of rebellion, which is exactly what took place. Now, if God chose, as the sovereign of the universe, to give man the capacity of freedom, and if man, as a free agent, makes a choice, there is no reason why God should be indicted for the consequences of man's freedom. And this is what we're facing mm-hmm. today. People are blaming God for what they do. They're free to do it.
You want to comment on the telegram?
Oh, yes,
EJ?
I certainly do. one of the things that perplexes me constantly is that the religionists say that God created everything. He created people, he created the world, he created certainly the whole situation in which we find ourselves. And I find myself really confused at how any being, all-knowing and all-powerful, could create, let's say, anything like me.
That's a good beginning.
And some of my detractors would like to stop there.
I think we should just go home now.
Can't stop that, CJ.
And put me into the difficulties in which I find myself, you know, besieged by these, I got a comedy setup going here. But seriously, that any being that was completely omniscient, for instance, and omniscience would therefore mean to me that he could see into the future, that he could see all the pitfalls to which I would be subjected, and that such a being with all this knowledge, all this foreknowledge, as a matter of fact, would make me as weak as I am, and then would put me to a test. This has the characteristic of a sadist.
Well, may I comment on this? First of all, He made two statements. The whole situation in which we find ourselves, this is not God's doing. God created a world which was finitely perfect and gave man the capacity of choice. We plunged ourselves over the abyss. We are responsible for the conditions we find ourselves in by his permissive will. He allowed us to do it, otherwise we were robots.
Are now, we not part of this world that he made?
I firmly believe this, but this is a very good point PJ's made, and I think we ought to answer it as he's made it. It's a very good point. The whole situation in which we find ourselves, if you want to use the existential situation in which we find ourselves right now, is not God's doing but ours, because it's a choice of man to direct his own future, and God has allowed him to do so, because we are free in that sense. Now, as far as creating you, as weak as you are, if I can get this one point across, then I'll let you chop at me all you want. God primarily, when he created any will in the universe, knew automatically that the risk of rebellion existed, because if there's freedom, there's the choice of rebellion or of conformity. He was willing, knowing the choice of man, knowing all these things, to allow us to make our own choice, because God desires that we love him. You can't love by compulsion. You love by volition. Nobody can compel you to love anybody, because the moment they try to, it's no longer love. God wanted love, and he wanted fellowship. And to do this, he had to have responsive moral agents with that capacity.
I'm sorry. I have to get in here. I feel that when you give...
Let him finish.
Can I finish this one point?
Please,
I realize that there would be differences. He didn't make you as weak as you are. You became that by your own sin. And despite your sin, he still loves you. And I think that the Lord also has a very good sense of humor, because, to quote PJ, after all, he made us.
May I say that you're thinking of God in terms of man.
No, I'm thinking of God in terms of freedom.
Would you repeat what you said about love just a moment ago?
Yes. To me, at least so far as we're able to determine in the human relationship, love is not compulsive, it's volitional. If you compel somebody, if you put a gun to somebody's head and say, love me,
yes,
this is not love.
Yes, but you see, you have the so-called omnipotent who is giving us all these rules, really, along with giving us this world that you mentioned.
And also giving us existence.
Yes, but you see, I believe you're talking in terms of man's ability to love other men and women.
Well,
and mankind.
Yes, I would have to speak anthropomorphically, because I can't speak in the terminology of heaven when obviously I'm limited by the finite confines of earth.
Well, I'm so distressed, Reverend Martin, about the way you are speaking about God.
I'm sorry I shocked you.
Do you really feel God is an elderly gentleman with a nice long white beard on a cloud?
No.
Don't you feel that God is the creative principle, which is in and through every bit of his creation?
Well, I can answer this by saying this, that the creation cannot be greater than the creator. And
well, certainly. But
now, just a moment. You are a cognizant, reflective ego. You're sitting here talking to me in a subject-object relationship. You are a person, I and thou, to quote Martin Buber. We're together right here, I and thou. That means that we are egos. We're personalities. Descartes said, because I think, therefore I am. All right, I am as an ego, and you are as an ego. Now, if God, who created us, is principle, he is impersonal, and he is not ego. Therefore, the creation is greater than the creator, and this is rejected a priori, immediately.
Well, why?
Nobody would accept this.
Well, I don't understand you. Would you explain this again, perhaps in a simpler way for me?
I'm sorry. My point was this, that if God in what you're talking about is a principle. A principle is an abstraction.
A principle and a wisdom and an intelligence.
But an abstraction, not a person.
Not a person. No.
Correct. Therefore, if not a person, not an ego. Because person implies personality and ego.
Yeah.
I don't know why you would say that as though you know it so absolutely.
Well, I'm speaking in the context of what our Lord's teaching is, and I am speaking from a Christian standpoint. I grant you this.
See, if you take it from any other people who might be atheists, agnostics, Buddhists, etc., and Buddhists are atheists.
And cultists.
And cultists all around the world, you'll have a variety of people who will disagree with you. Just because you say it or your religion says it doesn't make it so.
That is correct, and what we would have to do in order to prove this would be to show the highest probability of which view was correct in all the religions.
Yes. If you have God and his creation, then you have duality, don't you?
There is duality, because you're sitting here talking to me, your lips are moving, you're verbalizing concepts which are being formed or have been formed in your mind
and
stored. There's a duality in you right now.
Above the duality is the one, isn't that so?
Above the duality of flesh and spirit is the monotheism of the one eternal being, God.
Yes.
The great, those who accept
the great eternal. Well, I'm speaking now in terms of an accepted category.
Right.
If we're going to defend the concept of God's existence, now we're in a different plane. We can do that. I'm only speaking primarily
but
now in the terms of this category.
Isn't this being in and through all his creation?
No. That's pantheistic, that God is in everything and permeates creation. God is transcendent. He is apart from creation as creator, and he works through creation as redeemer. But he is not part of the stuff of creation. Otherwise, if
well,
we do
no
that,
redeeming...
then he becomes part of the microphone, part of the
That's
table.
That's right, yeah, sure.
Well, this is
I would assume
you.
And
that
then
any
there, is,
God
not, there is nothing to be redeemed because it is all God and all perfect.
There's only one problem involved in this. That is, if everything is all God and everything is all good, where did the idea of evil, which is the opposite of God, originate?
From an idea of separateness, a misunderstanding of separateness.
Then you have to account for the origin of the idea.
And, you know, I'd like to say something on this point.
Can't stop you.
Do you share the view that God created everything? Now, either you do or you don't.
By everything, you mean the visible universe,
the
man,
world, every atom that exists.
Everything that exists, did God create it or didn't he create it?
All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made.
Fine.
Right,
let me go on.
He saw it was good, didn't he?
Beg pardon?
According to the Bible, he said.
According to the Bible, when he looked at it,
it was good until we got into the act.
Just a moment. Now, you see, look, just a moment.
Go ahead, PJ.
God then created hell and Satan and the rest of it.
No, God created hell. God created Lucifer, who became, by his own choice, the antagonist of deity.
But it all grew out of God's doing,
said,
did it not?
Grew out of God's volitional choice.
Yeah. And how could
but there is
God,
such
how
a thing
could
as
God,
Lucifer?
No, but how could God
no,
create?
There is no Satan.
Well, biblically, there is.
No, but how could God create something imperfect? You see, here's the whole thing.
There was nothing created imperfect.
But just a moment,
everything.
Just a moment. There had to be a flaw. There had to be a basic flaw in Adam, so-called Adam. I don't believe this Adam and Eve mythology. But if I grant
but if
you...
If you don't believe it, how can you use Adam as an example?
Well, no, but I just to... Just,
oh, we can use it as an illustration.
As an illustration.
Oh, yes,
as an illustration. You say there was an Adam who fell from grace. Now, if this is true, if God made Adam, God should have foreseen and he should have made Adam of a stronger moral fiber than he was, quite evidently, to have fallen as he did fall.
Well, what you're really saying then, PJ, is if I were God, I would have done it differently.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying I'm getting around.
Is that what you're really saying?
No.
God should have done it. If I were God, I would have done it that way.
Would you like me to tell you what I'm saying?
That's what you're saying.
No, don't you tell me. Let me tell you what I'm saying. I'm saying to you that men created God.
How do you prove this?
God is a projection of men's minds.
This is Feuerbach. Now, how do you prove it?
But you see, he's being as dogmatic as you are.
No, I said this. I said within the framework, now, if you interpret me correctly, and if I haven't made myself clear, I will. I said within the framework of Christian theology. We're not discussing the proofs for the existence of God.
You see, but each time you say this, however, you give us dogma that we then must question.
Well, I'm willing to discuss dogma and question it and for free discussion, but what I'm pointing out here is this. P.J. says, and I'm quoting him now, I believe accurately, that there must have been a flaw in Adam because Adam, as an illustration, fell from grace. Now, if God were creating something perfect, then he wouldn't have created this the way he did it. There would have been a no fiber of imperfection. There wouldn't have been any of these conditions. It would have been a perfect thing. But what actually is being said, and this is a very subtle thing, although we don't like to admit it, P.J. is really saying, in essence, if I were God, I would do it this way.
That is not what I'm saying.
I don't
Please
think he
don't
is.
Interpret for me. Let me tell you, I use English fairly well, you know? And if I meant that, I would have said that. That is not what I'm saying at all. But I am merely going along with the postulate that there is this God that made the Adam. I don't even believe it, don't you see?
Yes, I know.
You see. So I'm saying to you, however, that taking your postulate, I go on from there and I say that if this God, this all-knowing, this all-powerful, all-perceiving in the future, all-foreseeing God, were to make an imperfect vessel and then charge this vessel, this imperfect vessel, with sin or with some dereliction because this imperfect vessel behaved imperfectly, this doesn't
It's unfair, and I agree.
But, may I make a statement
here?
God did not make imperfection in Adam. We're assuming imperfection in order to attack God's creation.
Well, how could he have done an imperfect thing if he was perfect?
All right. You remember the mist that fell over?
God said thou wast perfect of Satan until iniquity was found within thee.
Where did the iniquity come from?
I'm trying to get to this one point.
Yes.
According to the best information we have, biblically speaking, the cause for evil was the rebellion of a free will by its choice against its creator.
Where did they get the free will?
God invested man and angels with the capacity to either... To either respond to his love or reject his love. Now, if they chose to reject his love, this, of course, would be sin. But it would be a free choice.
But if he gave them the choice of accepting or denying anything...
Yes.
He also suggested with this action that...
Whatever you do is all right.
Whatever you do is still from me, since I made you.
No, not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
Because God
is strange
infinite.
Term.
God is infinite, and man is finite. If God created man infinitely perfect, then man would be God.
I think you're rationalizing the point. I think you're saying that because it fits the argument.
Well,
but
I think over the years,
people have argued this way because they wanted to explain away certain things which they could not explain.
I can't explain away. I quite agree with you, as does C.S. Lewis and quite a few Christian theologians, that the problem of evil itself has inadequate data for an absolute pronouncement.
Thank you very much.
I'm only pointing out that there are alternative propositions to saying God's responsible. That's all.
Let me just interrupt here for a moment to take care of some business. And now, back with our guests of the morning. If I may, for just a moment, well, first let me reintroduce our guest. Reverend Walter R. Martin, assistant professor of biblical studies at King's College, Briarcliff, New York, is our guest of the morning. And we've invited P.J. Sidney, actor, Eden Gray of Inspiration House, the bookstore, and Roy Schatt, photographer. If I may digress for just a moment, I have talked many times with rabbis, and we've had some pretty hot hassles here by having an Orthodox, a Reform, and conservative rabbis on at the same time. And I hope that no one is offended. This is not being critical, but just a little bit of knowledge that I acquired, and maybe everybody in the world knows it, but I didn't. You know, you talk in terms of kosher things, you know, foods and things like that, and kosher slaughtering methods and what have you. Did you know that a rabbi must wear kosher clothes?
No, I'd never heard that.
And do you know, I don't know how you pronounce this, is it Shatness? S-H-A-T-N-E-S?
Shatness, I think
Shatness.
So, yes.
Shatness test by the Shatness Laboratory. And presumably, if you're a rabbi, you would not wear the garment unless it had this seal on it. And when you have this seal, there's a little wire and an extra little seal that this is clamped on. And this means that the garment that is made for you has been approved. And in other words, you cannot have wool and linen. You could not use a linen thread. If you're sewing a wool fabric, for some reason, there is something that would be non-kosher about this. I thought it's interesting.
Well, is that anything like samurai?
Can a rabbi wear a linen shirt with a wool suit?
That's an interesting thing.
Or
I don't know.
Would it have
See,
to be
right
a
away, I
shirt.
Give a little piece of information, and you become hungry for knowledge. I'm not going to give it all away tonight. You'll have to tune in again at a later night, and we'll give you the rest of it. I thought this is interesting. You know where I found this out? I went down to Mr. Tony's, you know, the sponsors, the mm-hmm. custom tailor, and they've been sponsors for some time. And I was down there talking with Milton and Mr. Tony, and there was a rabbi there. And a few weeks ago, I was down there. There were two rabbis and two priests that were buying clerical garb down there. But this rabbi asked something about the label. And I couldn't figure what he wanted. Then it dawned on me, evidently, he didn't want the name of the company in his garment. For what reason, I don't know. And I thought he was trying to tell Mr. Tony not to put the Mr. Tony label in, which, for some reason which I wouldn't understand, would certainly be his right anyway. And so they made a deal about this, and the garment has to be sent. So I got involved in it myself, and I found out that the garment, when it's completed, is sent to the Schottnitz Laboratory. And they, in turn, test, using some method, to find out whether there's any linen, if it's a wool garment, used. And then they give the seal. It's located out in Brooklyn. And Evergreen 78520. And they've got a microscope on here. And they evidently use that microscope. And then it says here, non-Schottnitz, tested by the Schottnitz Laboratory of such and such Avenue, Brooklyn, guaranteed only if label is attached by this seal. In other words, the label can't even be stitched to the garment. They have this little wire to hold the label on, and that becomes a seal. And it's the N.S. Schottnitz Laboratory.
I would have
the end
a question
the
about the wire being metal.
Well, no, I'm sorry. I shouldn't say it's wire. Maybe it's some other material.
I just wonder about it.
I don't
all
know.
Those things would...
But I know this is attached separately, but not the label is not stitched.
Yes, I see.
To the garment.
Mm-hmm.
Little bits of information that you gather in the Long John Neville Show. And tomorrow night at this time, I'll be telling you how to make 3 minutes soft-boiled eggs in 2 minutes. I tell you, people, I mean, you want to sit back, but tomorrow you'll be talking all over town giving this little bit out as if you discovered it yourself,
right.
See? You sit back, relaxed, as if this is a nothing. All right, let's get to the telegram. John's show is a success. Can't miss for top rating. Signed, Bobby. This did not come in after this Schottnitz thing.
he may want to revise
that's
that.
That's right. Bobby, you want your money back? Here's another one. What is this nonsense of excesses attributed to Moses and Joshua, and they're condoning the killing of children for religious purposes? Morris H. Finer sends this.
I believe that I stated before that there are those who charge Judaism with excesses, and they charge Moses and Joshua.
No, you said in their time. Not that Moses did it.
I didn't say that. I don't agree that Moses or Joshua did this as an excess. I believe that whatever judgments God dictated in the Old Testament for reasons known to himself are his own business, and I'm willing to, as I think anybody should be willing to concede what his judgments are. But there are those who do maintain that such as the extinction of the Canaanites was a barbaric thing, and I pointed out that just because some people state this doesn't necessarily mean that you have to believe Judaism is barbaric, that's all.
Right. I have this to say, that even here is illustrated quite clearly that if you had five people watching a scene, you're going to have five different stories about that scene. There's no doubt about it. We've proven it with a game that is called the, ten people, one of them reads the typewritten piece of paper and whispers it one to the other.
Jack
and
Barbie.
By the time the end of the thing, as you must have heard, in one evening, there is a complete difference. The last man speaks it out loud and it's nothing like the sheet of paper that was originally written. Now, I have this to say, in many, many thousands of years, let's say a couple of thousand years, just a couple of thousand years, things were bound to have been misunderstood, revised, particularly since reading started after Gutenberg in 1440. He was the guy who invented printing with movable type. And his first bit of printing was the Bible. And as a matter of fact, I think it was something like 89% or more of the people of the world were illiterate and had to be read to and read for and written for to their different people, so that most of this was done by talking from one to the other, so that these stories were revised and revised, and even the written stories that could be read were revised, because each person had a point of view.
Well, if you're going to apply this to the transmission of the Old Testament, which I assume is what you're saying.
Am I correct?
I'm going beyond that when he finishes.
Okay, may I bring this point out? Of course, this is a problem of what is called textual criticism and the study of transmission of manuscripts.
Yes.
But it is quite a significant thing, I think, that we ought to take into consideration, that in the study of the manuscripts of the Old Testament,
yes,
for instance, the Isaiah manuscript, which we just found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is dated 150
to 200
BC.
Which I want to talk about next.
Yeah. Now, you bring that scroll in, And let's say from 150 B.C. to 1964, right? That's better than 2,000 years. Now, you would expect to find, on the basis of what you were just saying,
yes,
enormous discrepancies in a book as large as Isaiah. It's a large book. Yet the scholars who translated this commented on the fantastic accuracy of the Isaiah manuscript to the manuscripts we possess today, some in the 13th century and some up to the present moment. And it was Dr. William F. Albright, who was and is considered the greatest archaeologist alive. He's on the faculty of Johns Hopkins University. His book, From a Stone Age to Christianity, is the classic in the field. Dr. Albright has never been a friend of historic Judaism or Christianity, so he's an unbiased source from that standpoint. Dr. Albright says, after studying the archaeological remains of the Old Testament, there is no doubt that it is the most fantastically accurate thing that has ever been confirmed by archaeology.
But I'd like to say
now,
this.
I've got to bring this point out because I think it's important. The actual transmission of Old Testament manuscripts, according to the best Hebrew scholars, is the most accurate of any world religion, and not only the most accurate, but has so little transcriptional error that it's almost fantastic. The New Testament, which is also a document almost 2,000 years old, has been validated from four major manuscripts and literally thousands of fragments found in different places by different groups, so they could hardly be accused of collusion. When they're all brought together and studied, they tell essentially the same story with minute variation.
Not minute.
Let me finish.
Quite
what I'm
big
saying.
Changes.
Let me finish what I'm saying. Now, when I say minute, I mean minute, and I would welcome any enormous changes that you might adduce at this point, because Dr. Bruce Metzger of Princeton University has stated that we have 97% of the New Testament right at the present moment, probably from the tracing the manuscripts back, and its accuracy is beyond all dreamed reconstruction, which I think is fairly good evidence for accuracy of the Bible.
Keep on making new translations?
Well, this is the result of finding manuscripts which shed a little finer light on one passage. For instance, if you come across a passage where a word has been, through the centuries, construed one way, then you get an older manuscript where this particular word is given in context a sharper meaning. You don't change the passage, but you can certainly give a tremendous impact to the passage with this additional information. Now, the New Testament itself and the Old Testament, I would stand 100% behind the statement of both Jewish scholars and Christian scholars. These are the most accurate of all manuscripts of any religions in the world. Fantastically accurate.
Let me interrupt for a moment. We're going to take a break at this time.